Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. So glad that you joined us on the broadcast today. I was just looking at a couple of the numbers related to the program just last night. I put a little bit of this out on social media, but we at the end of the month of June, we reached a couple of ministry milestones here. In the program, one was we now have over 1,500 broadcasts have been uploaded out there to sermonaudio.com. That was one. We now have over 12 million page views on the blog. I don't do the blog for every broadcast, but a lot of broadcasts I will blog a little bit about what the subject will be about, and that's over 12 million blog views now. And then a little bit over a million of the sermon or the broadcast pages that are out there as well. People have gone there over a million times. So about 500,000 downloads of the broadcast in all 50 states and about 70 different countries on a regular basis on the program now. So we just thank the Lord for blessing the ministry in this way, and pray that you would, or ask that you would continue to keep us in your prayers as we seek to talk about issues related to today and talk about those issues from a biblical perspective. The one that I want to talk about today, I saw out on, this was on the Cornwall Alliance website. They had been last month, I think they were giving away a copy of this book, and it caught my attention. And so I started reading about this book and found it very interesting. And so I thought I would bring it to your attention today. And basically, you know how that when we listen to the hyper environmentalists today, you know, the radical environmentalism that's taking place, and I say radical, it almost sounds like it's, you know, way out of the mainstream or something, but it's basically now the views that have been adopted by many people in the leadership of our country, including the president, you know, has adopted many of these types of philosophies and so forth. But there's always this this doom and gloom that seems to go along with it. I don't know if you've noticed that, but it just seemed to be against anything modern or any sort of modern innovation and these types of things, and really come across as just being quite doomsayers on a number of things. Well, this is what this book addresses. And this is why I thought it would be interesting for us to look at it. The book is called Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper: How Innovation Keeps Proving Catastrophists Wrong. And in the description of it, it says this. It says, in the face of today's environmental and economic challenges, doomsayers preach that the only way to stave off disaster is for humans to reverse course, to deindustrialize, to relocalize, to ban the use of modern energy sources, and to forswear prosperity. But in this provocative and optimistic rebuke of the catastrophists, Robert Bryce shows how innovation and human desire to make things smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper is providing consumers with cheaper and more abundant energy, faster computing, lighter vehicles, and a myriad of other goods. That's what we want to talk about on the program today. Joining us is Robert Bryce. Robert is an author, a journalist, public speaker. He has written numerous articles, and his articles have appeared in dozens of publications ranging from the Wall Street Journal to the Atlantic Monthly to National Review. He's the author of five books, including Power Hungry, The Myth of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. That one was published in 2010, and his most recent book is the book that we're talking about today, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper: and it was released in 2014. He's also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he lives in Austin, Texas. Robert, it's a pleasure to have you on the Knowing the Truth radio program today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, Robert, I gave a little bit of an introduction there to your book, but let me let you give a little bit more fuller, more robust idea of what you write about in this book.
Well, thank you. I think your introductory remarks obviously were on point. I'd say this: the reason I wrote this book, and the reason that, you know, what was the motivation behind it, is this continuing drumbeat of dire warnings, whether it's climate change or the possibility of food shortages. A few years ago, remember, we had the whole peak oil thing where, well, yes, we're running out of energy. Well, no, in fact, we're not. We're not running out of energy at all. And in fact, in today's oil market, the problem is not too little oil, but too much. And that's why we've seen prices collapse by more than 50% over the last couple of years. So that was really the motivation behind it, that I had my fill of this, these gloom and doom predictions, all of which have proven wrong over and over and over again, and yet we continue to hear, particularly from these big environmental groups, and many of them have budgets in the tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars per year, that the way to salvation and human salvation is through going backward, to going back to 40 acres and a mule, the way, you know, we need to live in poverty in order to survive. And I just think it's a truly, I want to use the word reprehensible, and I think that's pretty close. It's the exact wrong way to go, and it's the kind of message that is being repeated over and over, and I wanted to address it head on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting the way that you do that. I like to do things more naturally myself, but that's just for my own personal benefit and my own personal choice, so that I wouldn't impose that upon other people to do it that way. I bought a little, not a farm, but some land, and I'm trying to grow my own fruit, and there's a lot of benefits to it and so forth, but I certainly don't. I'm using a tractor to do it, you know, and so I certainly don't want to go back to oil lamps and these types of things. I don't think there's any inherent virtue in doing that, and I don't think that there's any inherent evil in using modern equipment and these types of things, but they seem to say that there is. And in the first part of your book, you talk about the push for innovation and its consequences, and you know, how this has been such a real blessing, really, here to the United States and really across the world.
Well, there's simply no question. I mean, I'm on a mobile phone. It's just to give you a glimpse, I'm working on another book, in fact, on electricity availability. I've just started working on that. But the battery in this phone that I'm holding in my hand holds about 9 or 10 watt hours. The value of that electricity, the cost of that electricity, if you buy it from your local utility, is less than a tenth of a penny. And yet I'm talking to you as though you're in the same room with me right here, and I can also use this phone as for mapping, for, you know, if I'm flying an airplane, I can file a flight plan with it. I mean, it's an astounding amount, a bit of technology, and it's come about how? Through private enterprise, through innovation, through all of these things, and yet the drumbeat from the left is this, and it is a strategy, I think, is that, oh, no, the better way forward is that we should all use less. We should all be living in poverty because poverty is admirable somehow. And, in fact, this idea that is continually pushed by the vanguard of the green left, and by that I'll call them out, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, and Greenpeace and the rest of them, oh, well, we should go back to the land. We should deindustrialize. We should employ fewer people. We shouldn't be as rich as we are. I mean, this is just exactly the wrong way to go, particularly when we have so many people around the world living in dire poverty.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're dooming them in many cases where they impose these types of philosophies upon people. They're dooming them to a life of poverty, because along with these technologies comes the prosperity. And so
exactly. And energy is the key part of this. And that's where my, you know, I focus most of my writing and effort is on the availability of energy. And there's simply no denying that electricity is the essential fuel of modernity. And this is the part where you look around the world and there are these environmental groups who are fighting against coal-fired power plants. Well, for people in India, a country where there are 400 million people who don't have electricity, the government is doing what? They're building coal-fired power plants. Mm. And, by God, they should be building coal-fired power plants. Mm-hmm. That's the technology that's appropriate for them. They have coal in abundance in their country. And yet there is this idea that, oh, somehow coal is bad. Well, it's only bad if you have another option. And for the people who are living in the dark right now, they are happy to get electricity from whatever fuel they can obtain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine that because of your focus on energy and talking about how important and how innovative it allows us to be because of this energy, that you were probably pretty happy with what took place in the Brexit vote recently, because part of that, it really got legs with the British people when the government tried to impose upon them that they couldn't cook their or heat their tea any longer, that they were imposing upon them these stringent rules about their toasters and their tea. And once it hit the British people at that level with their tea and crumpets every morning, then that enough is enough. You know, we're leaving. And so were you pretty encouraged by what you saw there?
Well, that's interesting. I heard some rumblings about the regulations that you mentioned. I thought, you know, to me, what's interesting on the big picture in the EU, and I'll be, you know, be clear, when it came to the whole Brexit issue, I was not, up to speed on every part of it and didn't really understand all the issues. And now in the wake of it, I understand it better. And I think that for the Brits in particular, this idea that some bureaucracy in Brussels was going to decide how they manage their affairs and so on, I think, ultimately, I'm opposed to that kind of system. You know, you need people who are directly accountable to the public. And instead, there was a massive bureaucracy in the European Commission and so on that was deciding all of these things. So in that regard, I think it was awful. But I think more broadly, the energy issues now in Europe that are obvious is that, and now and they're becoming more clear in the wake of the whole Brexit issue, was that these efforts to require the use of renewable energy for these major economies has been catastrophic. Mm. And I wrote a paper that was published by the Manhattan Institute a few weeks ago, in which I just showed that the countries that have intervened the most in their electricity markets, and that's Spain, Germany, and the UK, they have also seen, and this is since 2005, those three countries have also seen the biggest increases in their electricity price. Mm. So these mandates of, trying to act like that these countries are really going to do something about climate change and global warming. The economic consequences have been severe, and I think that the Brexit is going to really put the brakes on a lot of those efforts.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be an embracing of the philosophy that you're writing against, this hyper-environmentalism and anti-industrialization mood among millennials. And yet they seem to be using these a lot of these devices that that are enabled by going smaller and faster and cheaper and so forth, as your book says here. How do we reconcile those two things? If they just bought into the notion that this is somehow better for people and they don't understand the issues, or how do we reconcile their embrace of environmentalism on one side and yet on the other side they actually embrace a lot of these technologies that are made possible by cheap energy?
That's a good question, Kevin, and I wish I had some glib answer that I could say, oh, I know how to deal with this, but I don't. I think some of the reason that we see younger people saying that they're so in favor of, some action on climate change and the rest is that they have been thoroughly brainwashed from the time they first got into school on these issues. And I use that idea of being brainwashed very deliberately, because there have been very concerted efforts to, push this kind of dogma that, modern energy systems are bad, that we're killing the planet, all of these things. When, in fact, without those fuels, without hydrocarbons in particular, we would all be, effectively going back in time by a couple of hundred years. So, the scope, but give the other side credit. You give the green, movement, the wind and solar lobby credit. They have been very good at the social marketing on these issues. So, you know, it's a long fight. It's not going to happen overnight. And young people are idealistic, and they like to, you know, think that they're doing their part. But it's not an easy issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, where the nonsense of it finally hit me was I was an IT manager in a hospital equipment manufacturing company in New York, and I was tasked with buying a lot of paper for the company. And so, you know, skid loads, pallet loads of paper and so forth. And it was right at the time where the idea of recycled paper was just becoming popular. And so there was this big push, you know, let's go ahead and, you know, we got to buy recycled paper so we can tell our clients and our customers, you know, that this is what we're doing and so forth. And I got talking to one of the guys in the industry, and he told me that the chemicals that were used in order to take the ink out of the used paper were more harmful to the environment than the process of actually just cutting down the trees and making the paper. And he also showed me a lot of data on how that the paper companies were not stupid. They were going out and planting far more trees than they were taking down. And so they knew they had to have a lot of trees out there to keep their industry going. So they were the biggest providers of going out there and growing more trees. And yet here was this whole movement because somebody got this idea, you know, that we need to just recycle this paper and this will do it. This will really fix the problem. And they were actually apparently doing more harm than good. Does that happen a lot?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that because what pops in my head was there was a story that was in the New York Times, oh, maybe 2 months ago, maybe a little bit longer, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And it was about the whole recycling push in, across the U.S. that, in fact, you know, this idea, oh, we're saving the planet, we're saving aluminum, we're saving cardboard, glass, and the rest of it, that the recycling efforts in some locations across the country had been so successful that they'd effectively collapsed the market for recycled material. So the net result was that this idea, oh, we're doing great for the environment and so on, was actually costing taxpayers more money because the value of the recycled material had fallen to the point where it wasn't really even worth money to recycle it. It was cheaper to landfill it. But because, again, the social marketing idea, oh, well, we have to recycle. Well, but what if it's cheaper to just throw it out? Well, we have to recycle anyway. And, you know, I see it here in my hometown or where I live in Austin here. You know, the city is ramping up their recycling efforts even further, despite the fact that they're, you know, the economics of it are just have become in many locations terrible.
Let me ask you one final question on this,
sure.
Robert. What do you think about this push now by the climate folks, you know, the hyper-environmentalists, where they now want to make denying climate change possibly criminal and put people in jail for denying these things?
Oh, isn't it quaint? there used to be, I remember there was this saying about the First Amendment and freedom of speech and, oh, we can differ on, you know, have different opinions. You know, it to me, it goes to the heart of the issue, which is, and I don't take a side on the whole climate change debate. I'm an agnostic. Tell me CO2 is good. Tell me it's bad. Tell me what you're going to do. And I've repeatedly said natural gas and nuclear. These are the ways forward, and they have been proven over and over to be the ways you reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But, you know, the whole push is, oh, the debate is over. We can't discuss this anymore. Well, if you can't discuss it anymore, is your position that weak? I mean, is your argument that weak that you can't defend it? And you notice that Al Gore and a lot of these leading climate activists, they refuse to debate the issue because they keep saying, oh, well, the science is settled. There's no reason to discuss it. Well, if your case is rock solid, well, why would you show up at every possible debate? And that's the part that I just think is, I mean, it really has gotten to a point where it's almost cartoonish, but it's not funny. And it's not kind of funny like a cartoon is funny because, in fact, they want to shut down open public debate on some of the most important issues in our society, and I find that really anathema to the entire idea of democracy and liberty.
I think you're absolutely right. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today on the Knowing the Truth radio program. We really appreciate the things that you're writing about, and looking forward to your new book coming out.
Thank you, Pastor.
Alrighty. That was Robert Bryce. Again, he's an author, journalist, public speaker. And the book that we're talking about here today is the book, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists, proving them wrong. And if you want to find out more about Robert and about the books that he's written, you can find out more at his website. That's robertbryce.com, www.robertbryce.com. Bryce is spelled B-R-Y-C-E. That's robertbryce.com. You can find out more about that book and the other book that he's written, and then he was mentioning another book coming out shortly.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.